Today is Wednesday. It's March 27th, 2024. It is 2:40 in the afternoon. And hi, this is John Williams. And this is the Mincing Rascals podcast, portions of which are broadcast Saturday nights on WGN Radio. Although with all the sports we're doing lately, we ain't getting much airtime. So thank you for finding us as a podcast. And do share us with your friends. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
Hi, I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter columnist, now doing the Chicago history website, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
I'm Austin Burr from the Illinois Policy Institute, and you can check out my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Brandon Pope, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago on WCIU, and the Making Podcast on WBEZ.
I'm Eric Zorn, the publisher and writer and sole employee of the Picayune Sentinel, a weekly Substack newsletter.
Sounds like you're filling out your taxes there, Eric. Is that what that was?
Checking all the boxes, yep. I have a very complicated tax situation.
Substack income is completely tax-free, I was told. Is that true?
That's what I've been telling myself.
Well, maybe since you're working from home, you get to deduct the square footage of your house as a business expense?
Just the home office.
Do you have to make sure that the home office space does not have other purposes? Does it have to be exclusive for the home office? Kate, it sounds like you're doing
this. It's supposed to be. My husband's a tax accountant.
Ah, so you know a little bit about this.
A little bit.
Well, then I don't want to know anymore. We still don't know who will replace Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox on the ballot in November, at least not officially. And for that matter, for the next term. Remember, this election last Monday was a primary, so Fox's term doesn't expire for several months. But I wonder what you guys think about the fact that they are maybe technically still, quote unquote, counting the ballots here in Chicago. Let me put it this way. Is this a created controversy, or in fact, is there really something truly troublesome happening here?
I have a lot of confidence in the people who are counting the votes, and basically that's because both of the campaigns have expressed that confidence, that they think that the job is being done correctly. I wish that it were done faster. I think it should be done faster. My proposal would be for them to require that mail-in ballots be postmarked by Friday before the Tuesday election so that most of them will have arrived by election day and they can count them so there isn't this uncertainty, which is giving rise to kooky conspiracy theories among kooky conspiracists who have WGN podcasts that we will not name. People are thinking that the fix is in, that they're waiting for votes to be counted for. They're waiting to generate votes for Harris.
John Cass is saying that. Cass is saying
that.
Yeah,
he's saying, oh yeah, it's really kooky, his theories, and it's being cheered on by his followers on his blog. It's pretty weird, although not unexpected, I should say. But
was he as nutty when he was a Tribune? Like, is this the same John Cass that you knew when you worked at the Tribune?
He's nuttier than he was. Than he was at the Tribune. He's really gone into Trump land and the far right conspiracy fever swamp. It's really something to see. But in any case, I don't think that there is anything going on. I agree. I heard Austin on your radio show yesterday kind of calling this election for Burke. And I think that as you look at these numbers, the stories are appropriately hedging. No newspaper or media outlet wants to be the next Dewey defeats Truman. But I don't see how, given the very few number of votes that are still out there to be counted, how there's any way that Harris makes up the deficit. And it's not a big deficit, but there's just not that many votes left. And they're splitting them, you know, he's getting 55% of these votes that are outstanding, but that's not nearly going to be enough. I think if this were ESPN and they were trying to give the win probability as it goes along, I'd say it's probably about 98, 99% right now for Burke.
Well, Austin, pick it up here because you pointed out to us on the radio and you have via the Illinois Policy Institute that when they say there's 50,000 ballots still outstanding, it's like we're waiting for this mother load of votes to come in. What does that mean? What's the status of that?
So an outstanding ballot, when people are saying there's this many outstanding ballots after Election Day, it means if you say there's 50,000 outstanding ballots, that means 50,000 people requested a mail ballot or were on the automatic mail ballot list. So a ballot went out to them and it hasn't been returned yet. So still even today, I mean, I think there's more than 40,000 outstanding ballots in the city of Chicago, but almost none of those are going to come in anymore because they have to be postmarked by Election Day. So basically 4 or 5 days after Election Day, you can expect that amount to trickle to a very, very minuscule amount. And I think that's part of what can fuel conspiracy theories.
That we don't have them means simply those people chose not to vote.
They're not coming back.
Okay,
those
keep going.
Ballots count. Exactly. But I do understand why media is not calling the race. And it's because based on all the information we had at the end of last week, it would have been appropriate to call the race for Eileen O'Neill Burke. But then there was an error from the Board of Elections in saying that actually there's 10,000 more ballots to count than we had previously been reporting. And that was framed as a communications error, which it certainly was a communications error. That was a really bad communications error. And they apologized for that profusely. But it also, and this is still not clear, and a good explanation hasn't been given, that could also be a very serious process error as well. Specifically, the fact that they were said to be Dropbox ballots from Monday. So people who had a mail ballot and they went to a box and they dropped it off. And the Board of Elections comes and picks those up every day. If those were indeed ballots from Monday in Dropboxes, there's no reason we should have had to wait until the weekend to count them. That is an actual process problem, and that isn't a conspiracy theory. Now, it is a conspiracy theory to say they did that to get whatever, $7,500 more votes for Clayton Harris. We don't know that. We do know, though, that is not right. There's something that hasn't been sufficiently explained about that.
About what happened to those 10,000, you mean?
About why were they not counted earlier?
It does seem pretty unlikely that Clayton Harris is going to catch up, but I guess it's not 100% impossible. From what I read, there is almost 2,000 provisional ballots in the city yet to be counted, and nobody apparently knows how many ballots are coming from nursing homes, either in the city or suburbs. So the last time I looked at a number, I want to say it was something like 1,600 votes apart.
Yeah.
And Clayton Harris at this point has been like slowly, you know, catching up, getting a little bit over 50% of the vote. I suppose technically it's not 100% impossible for him to catch up, but no one expects him to.
I take your point. I think there are, I thought I read somewhere around 2,000 of these provisional ballots or nursing home ballots. I'm sorry.
That's provisional ballots. The nursing home ballots, they don't know how many there are.
Oh, I thought that the Tribune had reported that. But in any case, Clayton Harris, the reporting has said that he's going to have to take like 80% of these votes, and he hasn't taken 80% of any batch of votes. He's probably not going to take 80% from nursing homes. Provisional, who knows? I mean, but if those are provisional ballots, it would seem to me would break down pretty much like the vote, pretty much 50-50.
What's a provisional ballot, Eric, in this case? What do you mean?
It's when you go to the register and your name is not on the registered voters list. For some reason, they say, you know, we don't have you here. You can cast a ballot and they set it aside. You give them your information and then they check your name against the actual most updated voter rolls to make sure. And they also, I guess they need to make sure when you do that, that you haven't also cast a mail-in ballot. That's how I understand it. Right. So that it wouldn't necessarily mean that one side or the other would be more likely to cast a provisional ballot. I mean, it is possible. It's possible for a team to score a couple of touchdowns in the last minute to win a game. And it's possible for a team to go on a real hot streak and score a dozen points in the last minute to catch up and win a game. But it's unlikely. And I've been watching this all week, and we could be playing this tape next week and laughing at me saying that I didn't have sufficient foresight. But I think that if you had to put any money at all on this, you'd put it on Burke right now.
I'm still not as exercised by this as maybe the panel is or some people are. I've been unaware of what the conspiracy theories are. Maybe that would agitate me a little bit more. But to me, as long as we get it right, Austin, last time we spoke about delays, we were talking about judges deciding whether or not Donald Trump should be on the ballot. There were other issues as well, like IVF in Alabama. But anyway, Austin, you were saying that you get nervous when we tell people to hurry up, make a decision. What's the rush on this thing?
There's a problem. There's a categorical difference between a court case and awaiting for the procedure of a court case to happen, and everybody already having voted and then getting metered out information that sets expectations of people about who's going to win. And I think by allowing this like 2-week period where a substantial amount of vote counting happens, I think that is just like a total breeding ground for mistrust in the system. And I know the reason for that is that is to make it as easy as possible for everybody's vote to count, which is great. But we've made it really, really easy to vote in Chicago and Cook County, and our turnout is horrible. And in part, that's because people don't trust the integrity of the system, some people. And there are really concrete, like common sense steps that can be taken to help with that. So, for example, I think the fact that Chicago has its own election authority and Cook County has its own separate election authority that just goes with the suburbs, that's an anachronism. That's from like the late 1800s, because that is, fun fact, the last binding referendum that we ever approved in Chicago was in the 1880s, and it was to create the Chicago Board of Election Commissioners. Those shouldn't be two separate bodies. And that's part of what's confusing about the reporting. You saw reporters getting it wrong because saying Clayton Harris has taken the lead when they were just reporting Chicago returns instead of Chicago and Cook County, for example. That's an easy consolidation, and that has been called on by the Inspector General's office. If those of you remember, David Orr and the clerk's office called for that. And the reason it never happened is because Madigan and Burke would always kill it. And it was because there were two sources of jobs that they could build out instead of one. So that, like, I think it's some time for a little bit of introspection and reflection from the election authorities.
I definitely agree with Austin that I think that this has shown we need to consolidate. It doesn't make a lot of sense for Chicago and Cook County to be separate in how they're doing this. So I definitely think that needs to happen by now. But I also think that it was irresponsible for some elected officials to dabble in election conspiracy and talk about things being found with quotation marks and stuff like that. I think it's really unfair to the election workers who show up every election and do a great job. And the last thing we want to do is inflame emotions and inflame potential outrage and even worse, maybe even violence toward those people. We've seen election workers across the country be the targets of harassment because of lots of conspiracy and conspiratorial claims. I'd hate for that to be the case here in the great city of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Dawson, do you know if that change would have to be a state law change, or could the city simply disband its election authority and cede it to the county?
It's a great question. And there's actually like some dispute about that because of how weird the setup was. The setup came from a referendum in Chicago in the 1800s. So I think there's probably a way that the city and county could do it themselves, but you might need to change state law in order to, I mean, when we think about a lot of other forms of government consolidation across Illinois, you do usually need a change to state law in order to do that.
About the faith in the system, what is the conspiracy theory here? What is it that people worry about?
People worry about a practice that in old school Chicago did happen, which is you wait, some precincts wait to report ballots, you see the result, and then you go get some more ballots to close the margin. Now, that's... And it's okay to talk about that. Like, Chicagoans should be like, yeah, this is part of our city's history and it's really bad. And we need to recognize that in order to kind of like overcome the conspiracy theories now. So the conspiracy theory is very simple. Eileen Burke is winning by 10,000 votes. And oh, look, there's more ballots now. That's suspicious. Oh, look, these ballots are more in favor of Clayton Harris. Look, the margin is, it looks like they found the ballots. Looks like this is classic Chicago. Looks like the fix is in. I should say, there's plenty of great reasons, common sense reasons, why a male voting populace or a late male voting populace might have different voting preferences than people who vote on election day mm-hmm. or people who vote early in person. That could lead to there being a mismatch in here's like the election day count versus here's what the mail count is. But this like lengthy period and these like tranches of votes from all kinds of different sources when the communication isn't good just makes that fear and suspicion way worse.
I agree with that. I'm not sure that there are too many documented instances of vote fraud in Chicago where you say like, oh, they found these votes that didn't exist. My guess is that what's going to happen, I've already said, I think that Eileen O'Neill Burke is going to be declared the winner in a day or two, and that there may be a recount, but all the air will go out of the balloon of the conspiracy theorists, because their theory is that Tony Preckwinkle is finding votes because she wants Harris to win because she's endorsed him and he's the party-backed candidate. And it's going to be kind of like the year 2020 when all the Republicans are howling about the rigged election, except the elections that they won. And those they don't have any questions about. And in this case, because O'Neill Burke wins, that's the one that the conspiracy theorists tend to favor. So they'll be all fine with it. They'll say, well, I guess the count was accurate. I guess it's okay. And then they'll start talking about how votes are going to be stolen from Bob Fioretti, who's the Republican candidate who's going to face the winner of this primary. So it never stops. They just change their focus. They just move on, kind of the way they do with Hunter Biden.
That's probably a point that doesn't get made often enough about the 2020 election for those people that feel it was somehow stolen, is that you're telling me people split the ticket, you know, that somehow the presidential vote got stolen or manipulated or something, but other Republicans down ballot who won, those were legitimate votes? I mean, how does that happen on the same ballots?
The only thing you can say to some extent in Chicago is it's kind of deep in people's collective memory of, you know, how ridiculous the machine used to be. If we want to be really charitable, we can say it's going to take maybe another generation for that memory to just completely be gone. I definitely can remember reading that there were a couple of West Side precincts where they would get zero Republican votes, and the machine would be like, "You idiot! You always give them at least one." That's to be charitable.
There's still the story about JFK winning the 1960 presidential election because old man Daley helped him out. I don't know if that story checks out, but it's certainly part of our local folklore.
I don't think our process is corrupt these days.
Yeah, I think that Austin makes a good point that we do need to make sure that this process gets streamlined in some way, because voter confidence in elections is really important in a democracy. And you can't, I mean, these polls are coming out showing a lot, more and more people seem to have less confidence in the democratic system, which leads you all kinds of dark places. If you don't believe that elections are on the square, then where do you go from there? Then you want to elect a dictator. Then you don't care. Then you don't show up to vote.
Yeah.
All these things are, I think, it's very perilous. So I think the election officials need to get their counting done more quickly, more accurately, and they need to come up with some systems. Like I said, I think that mail-in voting should be done a little bit early, so that we're not waiting for all these extra ballots to come in. And, you know, the idea that there are, you know, the idea is floating out there that there's like tens of thousands of outstanding ballots. And as Austin said, it's like they're not, the likelihood of them being returned in any number at all is minuscule. It's like if the Postal Service were really, really bad, then you might think that it could happen. But
the Postal Service is bad, but it's not 10
really
days
bad.
Yeah. It's not this bad.
It's not that bad.
It's not 8 days for a local letter. It's a day or two or three to get at the most to get a letter sent in the city or a piece of mail sent in the city. The days of that being necessary are just gone. And anyway, that's those kind of things to speed up the count to make sure we have some resolution more quickly, I think, is an important thing.
I want to reinforce the campaigns were great and urged calm and said we're you know, keeping an eye on it every step of the way. I thought that was really great. But people have to remember those campaigns disappear in a week. So if we actually want to take this opportunity to make some good change, that's going to have to come from people outside of those campaigns.
Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez spoke at a rally at City Hall where someone burned an American flag. And now Chris Taliaferro, another alderman, wants to censor him for being there and speaking there. In fact, we broadcast today a comment from a veteran who said he didn't understand how someone would burn a flag after he fought to defend it. Although, as I understand it, it was a veteran who, in fact, did the flag burning at this event. Neil Steinberg, who joins us frequently in the Sun-Times today, was good on this. He said, let's be crystal clear. Setting flags on fire isn't the issue. Every VFW hall has a special bin where used American flags are to be deposited, later to be burned with respect. It's burning a flag without respect as a protest, a.k.a. free speech, that bothers what he calls false patriots. Burning a flag in protest of something isn't so shocking to me anymore, guys. We've seen it enough. What's more concerning maybe is Sigcho Lopez's participation at an event by a group that plans to disrupt the DNC. That's more bothersome to me. Brandon, what are you hearing and thinking about this story today?
What I've heard about it, Sigcho Lopez, his camp is basically saying that they were not there when the flag burning occurred. He says there's video evidence to support that. I have not seen this video evidence. But he says he wasn't there when it happened, and he just didn't notice what was right there on the ground in front of him. And you can see in the picture.
He didn't notice the obvious burnt flag right at his feet. Right. Okay.
That's thin.
Okay. Now, that's what's being said. I think it would be pretty obvious. I think it is a jarring image. But ultimately, to have different members of city council call on censure for what is essentially First Amendment stuff, that is a little concerning. Ultimately, I mean, this was a bad move by Sigcho Lopez, not to speak at the protest, I don't think, but to be involved with something so polarizing, divisive, and something that even people on your own side of things probably aren't going to agree with you on. It's just not a good look at all, and sets things back from the issues he actually wants to talk about and needs to talk about within his own ward, within the city, and with the country. Obviously, they were having a rally talking about the Palestinian fight for justice over there in Israel and in Gaza, and all the atrocities happening over there. It's hard to stay on that message when you do something like this that distracts from that message altogether.
I'm surprised there's not one person has made a joke about the famous Chicago band Wilco song, Ashes of American Flags. That was my biggest problem with all of this. It's a very famous song and a very good song.
That's your hot take.
It is a good song.
His response saying, I wasn't there when the flag burning happened, raises the question, what would have been bad about it if you were? And I'd be very curious what he would say about that. Like, if his excuse was, I wasn't there when it happened, like,
even though it looks like it was.
Yeah, what if you were? And John, your point is correct, which is the organization is the problem. That's the biggest problem. And it's the organization that organized that event is called Behind Enemy Lines. The enemy in Behind Enemy Lines is the United States of America. And the people who participate in it are behind enemy lines. That is why they're named that. And that organization is posting material on its social media saying things like, make bruises from Chicago police batons the 2024 back to school fall fashion. That is in a post for getting kids to protest the DNC. Make bruises from Chicago police batons the 2024 back to school fall fashion. They also say Brandon Johnson is a, quote, ardent Zionist. An ardent Zionist is the mayor of Chicago. And then finally, and this one is the most chilling and concerning of anything that this group has posted, they say it's no coincidence that the organizations that are asking people to thank Brandon Johnson are the same organizations that are refusing to call for the DNC to be canceled and are instead working to channel dissent into forms that are acceptable to the imperialists, perfectly peaceful permitted protests and electoral lobbying. This is unhinged stuff. And if Sigcho Lopez had spoken at an event organized by far right nut jobs saying this kind of stuff about peaceful protest and ahead of the DNC, he would be rightfully and broadly condemned by everybody in city council and the mayor. And he's not. And I think people are getting too caught up in the flag stuff.
Wait a minute. In fact, he did speak at an event that was doing that. They're focusing on the wrong thing, is what you're saying.
Yeah. He partnered with people saying crazy stuff ahead of the DNC, which is very important for the city.
The right, and the thing is crazy. bruises on fall fashion. Like, what?
This is the group that calls the president Genocide Joe. They said you should go train car to train car on the L, persuading people, handing out flyers. We have seen in the past how an organization like this that isn't even of Chicago can make life difficult for people or events here.
I mean, like, I completely agree with Neil's point, and I'm sure, Brandon, you said this too, and you everyone who's spoken has probably already said it's politically protected free speech, and we probably all agree that it should be to be able to burn an American flag, whether or not we agree with it. And I personally don't, because I think Brandon actually already touched on this point, that it all it does is divide people. It doesn't persuade anybody. To me, when I see somebody using that as a form of protest, it tells me they're not interested in actually making a cogent argument, trying to get anybody over on their side. They really just want to make people mad. And they do a good job of it, don't they? So there's that on the one side. On the other hand, like Neil also made the point in his column, you cannot be responsible for everything everybody says at another event. Like, don't even let people appear and speak with anyone who disagrees with them, or they'll be condemned as being part of the far left or the far right. And I completely disagree with that. But this does seem to have been an event sponsored by a truly extreme group. I don't know how Cedro Lopez did not see that.
Do you think
flag.
He knew that? Do you think does he endorse that, the group and its efforts to disrupt the DNC, to create chaos, or was he just making a point about Palestine?
Well, he was speaking in front of a banner that said cancel the DNC and Genocide Joe.
Maybe he didn't see that either.
Yeah, well, he was looking off in the distance. I mean, one of my problems with this group is, I mean, I certainly am torn up about what's going on over in Gaza, and it's a tough, horrible situation. Clearly, and we've discussed it on this podcast. The idea that this is somehow Joe Biden's fault, or that we will be better off with Donald Trump. I mean, there's only two choices for president this fall. The grown-ups all know that we're either going to reelect Joe Biden or we're going to bring Donald Trump back from political exile and make him president. And the question for these people has got to be not, are we going to make a big stink about this, but are we going to go with the party that is most likely to be a friend of the Palestinians as well as a friend of Israel? And I think Joe Biden is in a tough spot. He's trying to navigate these waters. He may not be doing the best job. I don't know exactly what's going on behind the scenes, where he's putting pressure. But if you think that Donald Trump is a better friend to the Palestinians and the Muslims, you have not been paying any attention. So if you want to come to Chicago and create this enormous uproar and get the country thinking that the Democrats are bad and make it like 1968 again, and you think that's going to help in the long run? I mean, this idea, they just don't seem to have any long-term strategic plan. They just want to make a spectacle. And I don't think that's effective if you're trying to help the Palestinian people, if you're trying to help this two-state solution, whatever it is you're going for, if you want the ceasefire, you can't turn on Brandon Johnson, for instance, who was the one who orchestrated the ceasefire resolution in the city council and cast the deciding vote. I mean, these people don't know who the real enemy is. And that bothers me more than whether there's a burnt flag on the sidewalk.
Yeah, but you're skipping a step then, because I ought to be able to protest what's happening in Gaza and still support Joe Biden, right? I mean, are you telling me that if I want to support Joe Biden that I can't go to a rally, or I can't protest the way the administration is handling this?
No, I think you certainly can, and you certainly should make your voice heard. The question is, when you make these protests, do you make it less likely for Joe Biden to be reelected? Because
yes.
That's the choice.
Yeah.
And I think you can make your case without claiming that Joe Biden is in favor of genocide, or you make people think that there's no difference between Trump and Biden. I think it's perfectly fine to have protests to try to put pressure on the Democrats to move in whatever direction you wanted to move. There's a lot of organizations want to protest during the convention, they want to draw attention to their cause, and that's fine, that's good. But if you create this disturbance, if you make the Democratic Party look bad, if that's your goal, if you want to create such chaos that the Democratic Party can't get its message out, if it's all about how you're out in the streets fighting with police officers, then you're not helping. And that's kind of, it's like, I want to tell people, like, not now. The stakes are really high in this election this fall. And the idea that we're going to try to disrupt the entire thing because we think that we think somehow that Joe Biden is as bad as Donald Trump on this, it's just poor strategic thinking. And you got to think strategically if you're going to make any kind of impact.
Well, they do think they're thinking strategically, though, and in a way they are, because they have gotten Biden to move the needle from pretty much 100% backing what Israel's doing to now talking about a ceasefire more unilaterally. And, you know, as far back as even before State of the Union, he started talking about how Israel was conducting the war, no longer defending how they were doing it, but talking about them being indiscriminate bombing and such.
But maybe that's it. Maybe it is their conduct of the war and not the pressure he's getting domestically. It is, in fact, the way they are blowing up Gaza.
Well, I guess we don't know, but my guess is that he's changing his tune because of the domestic pressure.
Yeah, the way he's blowing up Gaza way before he started changing his tune. If he started changing his tune just off of, it was his first time seeing what was happening, I mean, that says a lot about his administration. But what Eric said here about progressives here, I think this is where both political ends of the spectrum get in trouble. The far right and the far left, as they engage in these weird purity tests, and they feel like a vote for their candidate has to be a vote of adoration. And you have to 100% align with every single thing that I believe for me to support you. And they don't see votes as strategy to get closer to an objective. They see it as just like this adoration, this right, declaration of love and devotion. And that's not the right way to think about policy, politics, or voting at all. You're right. I hate to say grow up, but it does give off like some, hey, I think you need to think a little more critically about this, because at the end of the day, why are you calling Brandon Johnson a Zionist? Like, what?
Yeah.
That doesn't even make any sense.
I want to be very clear here also. If there are huge problems at the DNC and there's unrest and chaos in a way that makes the city look bad, that is completely now the fault of the mayor for not standing up about this, city council members who refuse to condemn this behavior, because I mean, just think about this scenario that happened with any other alderman on any other issue. If there was some like pro cop alderman who went to a Blue Lives Matter rally where the group was saying, reject peaceful protest and let's get bruises from the police at the DNC, would that be acceptable from the city council? Absolutely not. If it was a pro-life group, if it was a Second Amendment group, if it was a pro-Trump group, pick any issue, this would be a five-alarm fire for violent rhetoric and an assault on democracy in what is ostensibly part of our democratic process, which is a national convention where there are nomination votes taken for the president. And because it's a DSA alderman, and because the mayor won't say anything about it, it's being completely like looked over.
What does DSA mean?
A Democratic Socialist of America. That's what Byron Sigcho Lopez is, and he was named. He's a committee chair. This man controls housing policy in the city of Chicago and is doing stuff like this. So I think the calls for censure are completely reasonable.
Calls for censure reasonable because of what you just said. But again,
if they're just saying this guy was near a burned flag,
that's how it's been framed. Okay. That is getting more attention than everything you just said, Austin.
It is. I think the wrong attention's on it. And I mean, there were news stories about like, here's the real story behind the guy who burned the flag. And it's like, well, that's not the real problem here, guys. Like, this is a really radical, extreme group that's being legitimized by an elected official.
And when you think about what's going to happen in Chicago with the DNC this year, maybe it'll go well, but you also have the immigrants. My worry was that that Texas is going to send us a lot of buses before the convention, that you're going to have this confluence of everything you don't want.
I mean, they are certainly still saying that they intend to do that. And it was a little confusing that the, I was trying to see who said this. It was the Tribune that said that Sergio Lopez joined the protest to criticize the Democratic Party's failure to take a clear stance on the federal government doing more to support efforts by Chicago and the other cities to deal with the ongoing migrant crisis, because he is calling for canceling the Democratic National Convention
right.
because of that, and because we expect more busloads of migrants from Texas because of it. So he's yet another one of the people calling to cancel the convention as if that's going to happen.
Yeah, that's a waste of time. Picked a hell of a platform to make that point, though.
Well, I mean, he is a strong leader in the ceasefire call. I mean, he attends most council meetings in a keffiyeh. I don't even remember the last time I saw him not wearing one. So he's very strong in that movement. And I assume that that's why he was speaking there. But according to the Tribune, that's why he specifically went. I don't know. Maybe he just was there for both reasons.
Yeah, right.
And I want to be clear. I think that protest is a great, I think, to get a message out, to have a protest, to have your voice heard is an important thing, and it can be effective. I think that disruptive protests where you are sort of deliberately egging people on, creating violence, ends up being counterproductive in almost every case. And that's where I think these people have every right to be heard, and they should be heard. And if the protests have moderated Joe Biden's thinking in some way, in some constructive way, then that's great. But if they're going to go out and burn flags and get in fights with cops, that is going to turn the public against them. And I just think that's why it's important to think, like, what is the purpose of this protest? How are we going to get a message across? How are we going to persuade people who are not yet persuaded? And I don't think that fighting with cops and burning flags is the way to do that. And I also think that the idea of canceling the DNC over this is insane. What possible purpose could that serve, except that it would make the Democratic Party look like it's in the thrall or under the thumb of this radical organization? That's not going to happen. So you have to have reasonable asks for your protests.
That's a good point. Because where are you going to put the convention if they – Arlington Heights, do they want that?
They have a big field out there.
By the way, speaking of the national scene, Ronna McDaniel is in and out at NBC. Should a network hire someone who was on the inside of the RNC when Trump was president? Should they have fired her after they hired her? The following people were hired by various networks: Michael Steele, Sean Spicer, Mick Mulvaney, Reince Priebus, Sarah Huckabee was for a while, all conservatives, of course, who have worked as news commentators. In fact, 10 of the last 14 White House press and communications directors have landed network jobs doing what Ronna McDaniel was ostensibly going to do at NBC. It's not clear to me if she was ever actually going to be appearing on camera as part of one of the panels, or if she was just going to be advising behind the scenes. I believe that was more the role they carved out for her for about $300,000. But my question for you is, would you hire her to advise you on the upcoming election?
I wouldn't hire her. I find it super irritating that MSNBC especially, and Fox News, I think they're probably the two leading cable news people who hire really specifically political people to be their main contributors. Like Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she went to Fox, as I recall. And I mean, they're just crawling all over the place at MSNBC. The press secretaryship at the White House is like the farm team to go on to MSNBC. And then once they're there, when they first join, they kind of pay lip service to, oh, you're actually a little bit of a political person, aren't you, Nicole Wallace or Jen Psaki? And they're like, oh, yeah. And then within a few weeks, they're just one of the team. And nobody questions what their perspective might be, including other than just an honest political viewpoint. And obviously they do have an axe to grind, but they're not presented that way pretty quickly once they've been there. There's plenty of smart people from any end of the spectrum that these cable channels could be hiring to be their go-to person.
Including a liberal at MSNBC, including George Stephanopoulos, for that matter. I mean, he was Clinton's guy. Mm-hmm. He was kind of the grandfather of that, now that I think about that,
at least in modern terms.
Right. I don't know if I'd hire her for, like, advice on the election, because my understanding is that she actually had a really tough time winning races or fundraising for the Democratic Party while being head of it.
Yeah. So
Republican. She's a Republican, not a Democrat.
Yes, for the RNC. So,
right.
I mean, I don't think I'd hire her to run a party, but I think these organizations reserve the right to hire whoever they want. I do think, to the point about, like, eroding trust in elections, when news networks do hire people from such explicitly partisan and political backgrounds, it does color people's opinion of that organization's news coverage, whether they like it or not. So that's something they should consider.
I've seen this at CBS at times. I watch them maybe more often than any of the other networks in the morning. And it seems to me like sometimes they go out of their way to present a Republican or Trump view so as to assure people that they're being fair and balanced, when in fact, sometimes those views deserve no oxygen or amplification. And that to me is where Ronna McDaniel lives, although she wasn't as much a denier as the Trump team wanted her to be. It seems to me like if you denied the election, then you have no place in an organization that is there to report the news truthfully. Full stop. If you deny that, your credibility is shot. You have no place in a news organization.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of commentators on these cable networks who are partisans. I mean, I think of, like, David Axelrod on CNN. Yeah, he's a Democratic partisan, Democratic operative. And consultant, he really knows his stuff, and his I think his comments are insightful. And when they balance him out with people on the other side, that's good. The Ronna McDaniel sin, it seemed to me, was that she was an eager, active participant in this effort to overturn the 2020 election. And at that point, I think you disqualify yourself from that sort of office if your network needs a responsible Republican voice. There are still plenty of them out there, people who are not tainted by that really sordid chapter in the Republican Party's history. I think the mistake was hiring her. I'm not sure it wasn't a mistake now to fire her, because you see on social media now that the right is all up in arms about the biased news media and MSNBC, this is NBC that hired her, I guess.
Yeah.
That NBC is part of the left-wing media irresponsible. And I think they just screwed up. Nobody really took a moment to think, like, is this the person we want? Is this, we have options here. And we're going to pay $300,000 a year for what? And I don't understand the decision to hire. And I think the decision to fire her was probably wrong too. They probably should have just packed her away somewhere.
But other than Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, give me some high profile Republicans you could hire to work for your news network that would give you some insight into the Republican machine or the Trump campaign. Who are those people with credibility who were on the inside?
Well, Chris Christie would be one who I know he's sort of a never Trumper, an anti Trumper, but he's someone who was not an election denier. Who's the governor of? I'm thinking.
Sununu would be good, New Hampshire.
Who's that? Say it again.
Sununu, the governor of New Hampshire.
Sununu.
My thing is, why even pay these people? I think that's where things get really icky and where we're losing sort of what journalism is really about. I think this whole saga just reinforces the fact that national news orgs do not know how to cover Trump still.
You mean networks, like national news networks?
They don't. Yeah, they're just baffled by it. Ronna McDaniel attacked NBC journalists, worked to discredit NBC journalists, worked to discredit the election, which is a democracy issue, which I think is something journalists should be partisan about, the saving democracy, something that we have an active part in. And so to bring on someone who has worked to discredit the people that work in your own building and pay them a large chunk of money after you've had layoffs, I know you've got producers who are asking for more money, and you're going to give this woman $300,000 to peddle, I don't know, her version of the truth? That's the other question, is, like, what is she doing when she's on there? Is she really being an objective Republican voice, or is she there to spin her own prejudices or try to get back in the good graces of Donald Trump, who has recently not been a fan of her? Interview her as a newsmaker, as Kristen Welker did. Hats off to her. Interview her as a newsmaker, as a person who's a political operative. Do not pay them. Just treat them as subjects that we have in journalism, because once you start paying for this stuff, it just gets really icky. Never should have happened in the first place. Hats off to the NBC employees and MSNBC employees who spoke out vehemently against this. It takes a lot of courage.
She said she had to take one for the team. That was her line, take one for the team, when she was working for Trump. But now she can more freely speak the truth, and presumably take one for the team means either ignore the truth or perpetuate the falsehoods. That's kind of what she was doing. But I wonder if the Trump administration staff are singular in this. That is, you could have a Bush, either of the Bushes, you could have one of their guys. You could have a Clinton or an Obama. Just work your way through the last few presidencies. Were there ever any administrations that so bald-faced lied to us about something so important and specific? And I'll even include weapons of mass destruction in that. Is there anything comparable to what the Trump team did? They were part of a singular, massive lie machine. That's the difference. That's it. Mick Mulvaney was on my show today, and he was one of the chiefs of staff and the head of the Office of Management and Budget for the Trump administration. And he was on CBS and got kicked off after everybody lost their minds about that. And he said, I didn't support the insurrection. He said, in fact, the next day I quit, but they still didn't want me because I was a conservative. He said, I think it's because he was on Team Trump that just makes it difficult to abide by these people.
Well, I would support like Mike Pence, for instance. Mike Pence was on Team Trump until this defining moment. I mean, and I understand being a supporter of the leader of your party and to a certain point, but when you got to January 6th, when you got to this insurrection, this attempt to overturn the democratic affair election, You've crossed the Rubicon as far as, and that's where the decision to hire her was crazy, and it would inevitably led to the controversy that they had.
I would say Mick Mulvaney kind of undercut himself, because I heard you talk to him, and at the end he admitted that he planned to be voting for Trump.
Yeah, I know. I should have spoken to him more about that, because he said, no, Trump lied, but I'm going to vote for him. But he said, because it's a binary thing. You either get A or B, and he says that B is bad. He's got to go with Trump because Joe Biden is that bad.
If he believed January 6th was that bad that he had to quit, he would understand that he should not be voting for Donald Trump no matter what.
Yeah.
In my opinion, I did agree with him that certainly places like MSNBC and Fox don't really want an opposing view with them. You know what? Not like I watch much Fox, but it does seem like they're a little bit more open to having somebody on because they do like to argue. MSNBC, though, I've never seen them have anyone on who truly contradicts what everybody else on the show already things. I mean, you were saying, could you have a Republican from a previous administration, for instance, Nicole Wallace? She was the press person for Bush. They get Republicans who, once they're there, you forget that they even were Republican unless they think about it. Like Michael Steele, right? Yeah.
I like Brandon's idea. Let's treat them like journalists. And by that, I mean, let's not pay them well enough that they can actually support themselves doing this. But if they were a regular guest, a contributor, we have people on our radio station all the time who are regulars. In fact, many of you are that, and we don't pay you for that, but you sure help us out with your expertise or insight in whatever the issue happens to be.
Well, see, our invoice has not arrived yet, so.
I'll tell you what, if they did, we wouldn't afford it because that's just not how my business works.
I do make a differentiation between people like David Axelrod, who they bring on clearly as an outside person, and people that they hire who are really part of their, anchor team like Jen Psaki and Nicole Walls.
It's funny, though, we don't know what role McDaniel really would have played, how we would have noticed her thumbprint on their presentation. Yeah. Maybe she would have been on a panel once in a while as the guest that you're describing her as, Kate. Mm-hmm. She wouldn't have been anchoring anybody's coverage, I'm sure.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. She was going to be like the Republican Axelrod.
By the way, how are your brackets doing? Eric, when all things are even, or he has no better reason or knowledge to root for one team in the NCAA tournament over another, said that he will pick teams from blue states over teams from red states because he's liberal and he's not going to support red state teams.
I will support a red state team if I've got some other rooting interest.
Well, that's what I said. No other reason or knowledge to root for another
team. Okay. So I will support a red state team if I, you know, but when all the things are equal and I'm looking at two teams I don't really care about, yeah, I'll pick the one from a blue state over a team from the red state.
Why?
Because I want the fans of the blue state team to be happy, and I want my fellow blue staters to be happy.
That's the punishment you get for living in Texas, in other words.
I've got to take up a gambling habit or something so that I can have a better rooting interest in that. But yeah, it's Big Ten
teams. Aren't the red state teams usually the best ones? Like, I think about the best programs. They're usually red
football
state.
They are.
You're thinking about Ohio State, aren't you, Brandon?
Wait a second. Ohio, look, we went Trump twice, but
I root for Big Ten teams always over anybody else. And as the Big Ten expands, it's getting harder and harder to. I mean, sometimes they play each other in these tournaments and so on. I got to pick a team to root for. And I guess, you know, some people choose by the uniform color. They always root for the underdog or something like that. But
or if the kids are from a school where you think they'll have every advantage in the world. It's easy to root for Yale because, of course, they'll be an underdog in the NCAA tournament. But in general, the kids that you think are wearing a Yale uniform are going to have two legs up on everybody else that's graduating from MC State or someplace like that. So you say, all right, then I'm not going to root for the Yale kids because they're at Yale already. They already won. So let's root for Nebraska or something like that. All I'm saying is I think there's a whole bunch of little calculations that people make that have nothing to do with basketball, but have a lot. It's hard to root for a Rick Pitino team. It's hard to root for. There's a school in there that is a religious school and has some views that I don't agree with. And if I thought long and hard enough about it, I think, why do I want to support that? And so I root for the other team, at least in my head. Eric, I was surprised when you said you got pushback from that because I think that's a very common thing people do.
One thing I do, I look at the makeup of the team. I look at, are they seniors? Are they juniors? Are they freshmen? I also look at, like, is it five white guys? It's five white guys in the college. They got a strong chance. They got a strong chance. A team of five bald white dudes going at it. That is a powerful basketball team.
Why do you say that? Why would you say five white guys have a good chance?
They tend to be the one. They sounds terrible. They're scrappy. They hustle.
They're all coaches' sons. They're all coaches' sons. And they're going to say these are high IQ kids. They're high IQ players. They pass the ball.
They're not going to the NBA. No. You know, they're not worried about a payday. They're there for their one shining moment. That's why teams like Kentucky lose. You can never go wrong with a team full of white dudes. You know. They ready to fight, especially if they're at a small school. They ready.
So you like Creighton in this year's tournament.
I love Creighton this year. I do. Got them in the Final Four.
I like the center on NC State because he's so bulky.
That's what I don't. And I don't like that team for the go ahead.
He
Eric.
Plays my. That's my game. I mean, when I'm playing ball anymore, I'm like him. I'm just like, what else? What other advantage do I have at my size?
He's a nose tackle. He's not playing basketball. That's the thing that bothers me about him.
Has such a silky smooth touch for the ball.
He does. I mean, he does. Impressive. I want him to lose 30 pounds, then I'll root for him. And I don't like Zach.
I want him to gain 30.
I don't like Zach Edey and Purdue because Zach Edey isn't even playing basketball. They just throw the ball up there, and then he inserts it into the hoop. It's not even a basketball maneuver. He just turns, and there's the hoop, and he drops it in. How can you get behind that?
It's the Big Ten. That's how I get behind it.
Yeah, I know. Well, if I had a 7'4" cool. guy that could do that, I think he would be my favorite player. Donald Trump's bond was reduced to $175 million. He goes on trial. He'll still have to pay the balance, though, if he loses on appeal. So I don't know who's exactly going to cash in on his properties or where the extra cash comes from. But it's possible that he is going to have to liquidate, or the state of New York or somebody's going to liquidate some of his assets after they seize them. He's going to go on trial for the hush money case on April 15th. Which he says will be good for his campaign, and it probably will. Austin, was it a good week for the former president, or was it a bad week for the former president?
I think I said this a couple weeks ago. It's like this, the trial drama, I think, totally plays into his advantage. He wants his name in the news. This is what 2016 brought, which is every week he's saying something wild, and it's wall-to-wall coverage about it. And I think similarly with all these cases, every single development is a new story. And he can reinforce the case that he's a political martyr. And the only way to rectify this injustice is to defeat Joe Biden.
So what does the panel think of my suspicion that the fact that he had sex with a porn star while his wife was pregnant is actually a plus for a lot of voters, that it shows how virile and manly he is or was?
That's your theory, Eric?
I've heard it floated, and I think I'm accepting it as my own, yes. I think that his supporters see this as a sign of strength, and that this is Trump's ace card, if you will, that people see him as much stronger than Joe Biden, and they want a strong, people who want a strong leader, and they don't really care that much about his positions. I think we've seen that Trump's policy prescriptions are kind of all over the place, and they're not really why people support him. I think they like the cut of his jib, his extra large jib. They like his expressions of virility, his a lot of these things that they're charged with. They think, I would do that too. And, you know, hey, I get a chance to have sex with Stormy Daniels. Heck yeah, I'll take it. So my wife is pregnant. She won't find out. I don't know. But it does strike me that a lot of these charges against him, he manages to jujitsu them into advantages.
Well, I mean, there's certainly some part of his base that I'm sure does have that feeling about it. But I think that there's that giant amount of religious Republicans, you know, born again Christians and such, who just refuse to judge him on that because they like him on things like abortion. And, you know, they're all about, you know, forgiveness. So you can't judge him on that. God judges instead. So they just shove that aside and won't even think about it.
Christian Wright is so transactional to me. Do they really think that Biden is that bad, or Hillary Clinton was that bad, or whoever was that bad?
It's a classic Bible sin, idolatry. We all remember the story of the Ten Commandments with the golden calf and people holding it up. And I mean, that Trump is their golden calf. And it's just really weird to see. I'm a guy, I'm a Christian, I read the Bible. I cannot find any scripture that justifies anything that he does. So it's baffling. It just makes you scratch your head.
You've got to order his Bible. I'm sure that if you order his Bible.
The Trump Bible?
It's not the Trump Bible? It's not the Trump Bible. It's the God Bless the USA Bible, officially endorsed by Donald Trump. And by the way, he is literally selling that because for $59.99 to help defray maybe some of his expenses here. It comes with the handwritten chorus to God Bless the USA by Lee Greenwood. It also comes with a copy of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and a copy of the Pledge of Allegiance. And in the Frequently Asked Questions section on the online order form, the question is asked, is this Bible officially endorsed by President Trump? Yes, this is the only Bible endorsed by President Trump. It includes the words of Jesus in red and includes a gold ribbon marker. I do think you're onto something, Eric, that the virility of Donald Trump, the indifference of Donald Trump, the sort of I don't care what you people think of Donald Trump, that plays. But at some point, the way it plays out, you think would give people pause. And clearly that doesn't happen. A winning week or a losing week, Kate, for the former president then? How would you score this week?
Oh, that is a tough one. He did get that bond reduced. I was reading Jonathan Alter's account of the beginning of the Stormy Daniels trial. He's sitting, sounds like he has like a set seat that he's going to get to be in the same seat for the whole trial. That's what he says, like 3 feet away from Trump. And he was really struck by how haggard Trump was, even though he was still perfectly coiffed, apparently. You do have to wonder when something like that isn't going to finally catch up with him at his age. And now we've got this gag order. He's going to be walking out of this trial where he's going to be getting really mad and then going to rallies. It's going to be very interesting to see if he can abide by this gag rule.
Even if you sort of energize yourself with the negativity, with the hate, you know, and you're punching back and that's your MO, you would think at some point this really would wear you down. He's been doing this since 2015, for crying out loud. This has been his life for 9 years.
Well, you'll notice that he doesn't have a very aggressive campaign schedule. He does little rallies here and there, but he's not on the road. This is not one of those campaigns.
That's true.
I'm not sure he's going to be wearing himself out. I think it was a bad week for him because he was not unable to get a delay in the hush money payments trial, and that will that move the needle with anybody? I don't know, but he doesn't want to be going on trial. As you remember, I famously predicted he would not go on trial at all this year because I thought his lawyers would be able to delay, and it looks like I was wrong about that.
But yeah,
it's the first time I've been wrong. So.
We got some email from listeners. Hey, King John, I just listened to the Mincing Rascals last week and had some thoughts. Did you ever look at Eileen O'Neill Burke's campaign commercials? She looks mean, and her name gives a Daily Machine kind of vibe. And John Catanzara, his endorsement gives a racist dog whistle, said Diane, one of our listeners. And also Richard said, good shows last week, guys, and this week, too. So I guess that'd be the last two podcasts. I like the way Eric Zorn responded to the ladies nitpicking about Biden's speech that last week. This week, I thought, John, you did a good job finessing the conversation. That is the failed CTU initiative before it got too heated. This was especially impressive because you might yourself have taken offense to some of Brandon's initial comments. Yes, Brandon was very spirited on that topic. Without going into all of those issues, I just wanted to say thanks for emailing us. Others have as well. But if you want us to comment on something or comment to something we've said, just email johnwilliams@wgnradio.com, and we'll try and include your comments or thoughts in our podcasts.
And I've gotten a couple of letters, I got to say, from people who are really pleased with Kate Plies and her addition to this podcast.
Thank you for saying that, because I'm just sitting here thinking, so he means me. I'm the lady who was nitpicking about
Well, it's funny because I got some email from people who don't like Kate at all. So it goes worse and ways, Kate.
I'm sure we all have our fans and all have our haters.
We have our detractors. I know that. It's good to see you and hear you, Kate. And Brandon and Austin, thank Eric, you too. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman and Ben Anderson. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week.
I'm making you look good, Eric.
I don't. They said lady. I don't think you're the lady.
It could have been Marsh.
I was ragging on Biden's speech. He meant me.
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well, and you know what?
John looked good too.
I'm glad you were saying what you felt. That's why we're all here. Thank you, guys.
All right.
Okay.
See you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.